Blog Talk Radio.
You said, I saw that in an interview, that you don't think novels are going to be read 25 years from now. Were you being provocative, or do you believe that to be true?
I was being optimistic about 25 years, really. No, I think it's going to be cultic. I think there are always people who will be reading them, but there'll be a small group of people, maybe more people than now read Latin poetry, but somewhere in that range, you know.
Is there anything you think that novelists can do about that, or is just that you think the narrative form is just going to die out? It's just the length of them, or what? Is that what's dictating you to writing shorter books now?
It's the print that's the problem. It's the book. It's the object itself. To read a novel requires a certain kind of concentration, focus, devotion to the reading. If you read a novel in more than 2 weeks, you don't read the novel, really. So I think that that kind of concentration and focus and attentiveness is hard to come by. It's hard to find huge numbers of people or large numbers of people or significant numbers of people who have those qualities.
Do you feel that the Kindle is not going to be that? I mean, when I'm on airplanes now, I now see people reading Kindles all the time.
I don't think the Kindle will make any difference to what I'm talking about, which is that the book can't compete with the screen. It couldn't compete beginning with the movie screen, it couldn't compete with the television screen, and it can't compete with the computer screen, I don't think. And now we have all those screens. So against all those screens, I think the book can measure up.
Welcome to In Our Craft, or Call It Art, Richard Weissman, and I've got a guest host tonight who is our own Pam Ray. So let me bring her on. Hey, Pam, is that you?
It is me, yes. Hello, Richard. How's it going?
Great. So I've got someone else. Let me just bring them on, and then let's talk about that opening, see what everyone thought. Hi, 585, you're on. You're on the air. Can you hear us?
It's Lauren.
Lauren, can you hear us?
I'm sitting here giving
hey,
you guys great greetings on mute. I'm going, oh, no. Good evening.
No worries. Well, thanks so much for joining us. And, I saw you had a poem in and amazing work as usual. So thanks for that. But let's start off with that really provocative statement by Philip Roth about the future of the novel. So, Pam, as co-host, I'll give you first word. What do you think of that as an idea, that the novel is dead, like Latin literature?
Huh. Well, sadly, I can agree with that. People nowadays don't have the same devotion and attention span. They want the fast action. My heart, really hopes that it doesn't completely die. It's like poetry, you want to see it continue throughout the centuries, and you want to see the ability for people to not only write a great novel, but for people to appreciate a great novel, to stick with us. But I can definitely see the truth in his statement, because nowadays people want things fast-paced. They want it now. They want to get to from beginning to end within, minutes. So, it's a sad truth, I think. The novel is, if not dead, definitely dying.
Yeah. Great insight. And Laurent, what do you think of that open?
Well, I think maybe the word you're looking for is moribund. It's alive. It's on somewhat of a limited life. much support. I mean, I think it's got many years left to go, but it is obviously the same place the horse and buggy was when the internal combustion engine came along, and it's the same place as the internal combustion engine is now that electric cars have come along. Shakespeare, I'm sure, would hate to see the fact that the play went away pretty much as the main staple of entertainment, given the fact that he was such an enormous influence there. And you can probably find other examples of societal changes due to technology replacing other things. I think that there's a word for that. It begins with the disruptive. It's almost a disruptive technology, a destructive form of entertainment. And, yes, we have now learned to absorb entertainment in 10- and 15-minute bits. So it's very difficult to focus on a novel, which is unfortunate, but I don't think it's ever going to go away. It's just going to be, it's going to have its small place on the shelf, let's put it that way.
Yeah, and that kind of sounded like where he was headed with the whole thing. And, you know, I don't know exactly when that interview was that was captured on YouTube, but he died in 2018, so certainly whenever that interview was, and I'm imagining it wasn't when he was on his deathbed, probably 2016, 2017, or maybe earlier, it shows that, you know, he definitely has tapped into the to the modern psyche. Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Pam, because what you were saying, you know, that you want the novel to still be read and poetry to still be read. I kind of feel like people's short attention span, that whole Twitter, however many characters limit, actually favors poetry. And maybe I'm being overly optimistic, but if people are going to read, it's much more likely that they'll read a short poem than a novel. So you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword, and maybe it's poetry's gain. And maybe that's part of what we're doing here on All Poetry, part of that renaissance of the short poem.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Go ahead, yeah. No, let us not forget that most of rap music, if not all, is generally considered some form of poetry. Look how huge that was.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, definitely.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, and it still brings them in. I mean, before COVID hit, I remember I was teaching in Manhattan in February of 2019. And after a day of teaching, I went over to Brooklyn and read one of my poems at a slam. There were 600 people in that slam. So definitely, it's pretty serious. In Brooklyn, people definitely take slam poetry very seriously and really good. I mean, I couldn't recite verbatim off the top of my head like they were doing long poems like that. So I was pretty impressed.
Yeah, it certainly
okay,
takes
it down
as well as
cultures and storytelling, histories, you know, the spoken word, not the written word, are usually better at that, I think.
Yeah. So he's kind of gotten us in the mood, and one of my prompts was him talking about writing. And I think that's where, if Pam, if you want to start there, that'll kind of be a nice segue for us.
Absolutely. Up first, we have Yet I'm Writing by Eva Polazzi. And Richard, would you give that a read for us, please?
Okay. So I don't see. Do I need to refresh my screen? Now I see it. Great. Okay. So this is Eva Polazzi. It's called Yet I'm Writing. fled words get born, cut out from my brain cells. A bodiless force is stabbing my brain waves till nerve fibers bleed, vowels and consonants. Electric storms discharge inside the neurons, changing my freedom to literate slavery. Dreams brighten up intruder verbs and nouns, and rhymes and rhythms do shaman dance around my synapses bonfire, drumming the spell of their runes witchcraft until my numbed mind climbs into the flames voluntarily. It's not me, but the typewriter on the roller coaster of an unseen energy lowered to withdrawal symptoms and lifted up to the sky-high surrender. If writing for me is an obligation, please, whatever you are, smoothen the birth channel of still unborn ideas before I bleed out due to birthing. End of poem. Okay, so Pam, as co-host, I will guest co-host, I will give you first word.
All right. Well, I always admire and appreciate Eva's writing, and I really love the imagery of and throughout this, and how the main thought of the poem is of the struggle of the creative process. I really like the imagery and electric storms discharge inside the neurons, changing my freedom to literate slavery, dreams writing up the intruder verbs and nouns. And I can relate to that in the idea of how focusing on that poem takes over, how there's nothing else in that moment that matters. I think what hits hardest for me, though, first of all, I do get a smile out of, and rhymes and rhythm do shaman dance around my synapses bonfire. That honestly, I mean, it's a pretty serious poem, but there is something in those lines that just makes me smile because I just can imagine it, you know. But if writing for me is an obligation, please, wherever you are, smoothen the birth canal of still unborn ideas before I bleed out due to birthing. I like that idea. To me, it speaks on the idea that we don't want writing to become an obligation, but to constantly remain a source of pleasure, even as we're doing it, you know, for work. So, you know, just a wonderful write all the way through, and great choice for opening the show after the introduction. So very well done.
Thanks, Pam. Yeah, and just so that everyone knows, the prompt that she was writing to was, I don't ask writers about their work habits. I really don't care. Joyce Carol Oates says somewhere that when writers ask each other what time they start working and when they finish and how much time they take for lunch, they're actually trying to find out, is he as crazy as I am? I don't need that question answered, which I thought was a really great prompt for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's him talking about writing. And second of all, it captures some of that Philip Roth humor. Because he is, I mean, in addition to being a great novelist, he's a great humorist. And, you know, he's just so funny. Portnoy's Complaint is probably one of the funniest novels ever written. And Laurent, your thoughts?
Yeah. When the muse wakes up, and regardless of where you are at any particular moment, and phrases and words start flitting into your mind, and they're interesting, if you're a writer, if you're a poet, there's no way in the world that you're not going to sit down, especially if it feels good, and take some notes and write what you're feeling. Regardless, I don't care where you are. If you're in a car, you'll pull over. Or if you've got a little recorder, you'll record. Or you'll try to remember. But, you know, the magic of those words goes away. So as they're hitting you, I can see that freedom is changed to literate slavery. Because, you know, dreams even, and you wake up and you want to write something down, so he addresses that as well. And doesn't it all seem very magical and wizardly how after a week of being unable to write, all of a sudden it's all there and it's pouring out and not a damn thing you can do about it. So the shaman dance, I can see that because it is very mystical, at least to me, how it happens. If you become a typewriter on a roller coaster, as he says. So I really enjoyed this.
Absolutely. Great comment. Yeah, I too really love that. And you both kind of hit on the stanza that hit me as well, which was the shaman dance around my synapses, bonfire drumming the spell of their ruined witchcraft until my numbed mind climbs into the flames voluntarily. It's just amazing work. And, you know, I love poems about writing and was hoping that someone would tackle prompt 11, and this poem did not disappoint. She shows the visceral pain and spiritual journey of the process that we who create know all too well, and I was right there with her throughout, praying not to bleed out, at least not this time around. Just amazing work, and great way to start us off. Okay, Pam, I'm bringing it back to you for our next piece.
All right, up next we have The Ever-Moving Philosophy of Beliefs by Daniel Dischino. And Lawrence, would you give that a read for us, please?
Certainly. How do I keep an open mind when the doorways are blocked with refuse and clutter? How do I keep from hoarding as I am consistently attacked and targeted by the hordes of sensory bombardment? What are the questions that bring answers and not more questions? That is a question of which I still question. Of the flesh, the fauna, and the flora that does not flow forward, death be a state of mind, not a state of body. Children are not of an age, but of a state of growth. Even the bedridden walk a daily path, for the body does not move without the mind. But what do I know? The truth is, not too much. The truth is, well, that's kind of a problem. Oh, not even as much as I might not know the truth. But I might, I don't know that I do. So through the catacombs of clutter, through the catastrophe of conformity, I turn off the lights within the world I have built and look for the local starlight that shines under doorways. And when open, I only see the path that lies before me, as every road connects. I search within religion for the science of God, and I study science for divine enlightenment. I philosophize on the laws of physics, and the laws of physics guide my path to the philosophy of the unknown. All roads connect, or not. End poem.
Nicely read, Laurent. And Pam, if we can start off with you, what's your thing?
Yes, well, first of all, I do have to say that was really nicely read there. I felt like you really, the tone of the poem, the pacing of your voice fit it really well. You know, it's interesting because Daniel's writings always have a bit of philosophy to them, but here he puts it straight in the title. And I like how this one comes across as almost going along on the journey with him as he goes through his thoughts. And it's always interesting to me how what philosophy is seems to vary. I mean, it might not technically, but like I read this poem, and the stanza about asking that question that doesn't bring more questions, but actually brings the answers. There's nothing physical about that. There's no science behind it. It almost has a wishful, dreamy quality. But then he gets to statements like, children are not of an age, but of a state of growth. And that is something that is both philosophical, but it can be proven. It's been proven over and over again that children do not develop at the same rate. this is just a wonderful journey of thought and the idea of, you know what, I want to be open-minded to everything, but sometimes there's just too much coming at me. It's like that one quote, and it was a poet who said it, and I can't remember who, but he died fairly recently, the one who said, if you're too open-minded, your brains will fall out. It kind of reminds me of that. Oh, and I wish I could remember what he was. He was actually the one, the poet I'm thinking of, and I can't remember his name, but he owned the bookstore that the poem Howl was first read at. You might know who I'm talking about.
Ferlinghetti.
Yes, that's it. Sorry, you got me sound so excited, but yes, thank you. That is him. And,
yep.
You know, but I like how this is philosophizing about all that is physical and not physical, and trying to find a balance. That way it feels like it's like trying to find a balance. So I thought this was very well done.
Excellent comment. Yeah, so, boy, you know, this poem, I could really go deep into, like, the philosophy and the physics and the math of it. But, all right, I'll do a little bit. So they end, I philosophize on the laws of physics, and the laws of physics guide my path to the philosophy of the unknown. All roads connect or not. And that really is, I mean, my understanding, and I am not an expert on fractal geometry and chaos math. I know enough to be dangerous, but what I do know is that it's kind of a mapping of the universe in 3D, you know, in geometry. And there is the infinite part of it, which is the guide to the path of the philosophies of the unknown, and it just keeps going, and the roads connect, and it keeps going, and it's infinite. And then there's what they call the dark side of the Mandelbrot set, where it's finite and it goes to zero. And so when he says or not, I don't know if that's what he was referring to, but it sure really does work. And it's a perfect mapping of the universe philosophically, because one thing that we know is that everything that seems so solid and so stable and, you know, Newtonian, once you enter the world of Einstein, Niels Bohr physics, all that solidity just melts right away. So the or not is a perfect end to kind of like, you know, the Einstein physics of our understanding of the world today. So pretty deep stuff and very well a good riffing off of the prompt that life, you know, from American Pastoral, he had learned the worst lesson that life can teach, that it makes no sense. And Daniel tackles it, and yet he does it in a kind of balanced and a little bit more upbeat way than American Pastoral approached that question of the meaning of life. And Laurent, as reader, I will give you final word.
Well, you know, we how do I want to say this? Well, after 5 minutes, I completely lost my train of thought. How's that? I enjoy the back and forth and contrast of disciplines in opposing ways. And I really do believe that it's all connected, or it all might unravel right before our eyes. I mean, the problem is we don't know. Physics and science will make a discovery, a breakthrough, and change our perception of things. And when you change perception of things, well, everything changes. You know, what might have been really powerful and valuable now isn't quite so. Things get substituted, et cetera. So, yeah, we don't know what we don't know. And all through this, he uses that when he discusses questions. What are the questions that bring answers and not more questions? That is a question, which I still question. So might not. And what else are you going to say? But yeah, great piece.
Absolutely. Great comment. And with that, Pam, I am bringing it back to you for our next one.
All right. Up next, we have Swiftly Passing Time by A. Shaknovsky. And it goes like this. As time slips by, I heave a sigh and wipe a teardrop from my eye. I ask myself the reason why our days on earth are so swiftly fly. And all God's creatures have to die. And no one can this truth deny. As time expires and death draws nigh, there is no choice, we must comply. And very much to our dismay, it's something we cannot delay. No matter how we hope and pray, it's written in our DNA. The mortal man who's made of clay cannot avoid that fateful day. When it's his turn to fade away, and all that's left will just decay and boom.
Great read, Pam. Yeah, so this was prompt one. Life is just a short period of time in which you are alive. And that's also from American Pastoral. Very, you know, strong philosophical offering on impermanence, driven home with a tightly woven rhyming scheme, and pretty flawless rhymes too. Very natural and lyrical. Nice piece. And Laurent, your thoughts?
Yeah, the lines. I ask myself the reason why our days on earth so swiftly fly, and all God's creatures have to die. You know, I imagine there's very few adults among us who, having raised a family, hasn't had a child or children say, "Dad, why do we have to die?" And you know, that's a tough question to answer to a child. Because, as he says, no one can deny the truth. We have no choice. We must comply. And that, to me, those were resonant words. Because comply we must, although we keep pushing back, don't we? I love the very natural rhyming and flow of this piece.
Absolutely. Great comment. And Pam, as reader, I will give you final word.
All right. Well, yeah, this has a wonderful lyrical quality to it. I do enjoy the rhyme and flow. I enjoy how the first stanza is more of a first-person narrative, his own thoughts of how he feels, and then the second stanza looks more at overall how humanity often feels, you know, and I do like the philosophical edge, and you know, no matter how we hope and pray, it's written in our DNA that mortal man who's made of clay cannot avoid that fateful day. You know, and to me, it's even the whole idea that it doesn't matter, you know, what your beliefs are or how you follow them or how you live your life, you know, it just, you know, at the end, you're going to die. We're all going to die and go back to that dust, that clay that we were made of. So just a beautiful and powerful rite and very well done.
Great comment, Pam. Thank you. And with that, let's move on to our next one.
All right. Up next, we have Vogue by Titus Llewellyn, and we have a SoundCloud for that. So whenever you're ready there,
yep.
Richard.
Okay.
Vogue. Inverti etheri. She'll adorn herself to those high heel shoes, gesturing more status style icon, wiggling firm adjustments into exploratory, fittingly flirtatious, to be admired at a man to bide attention. She'll pass, turn, smile, to look at herself, tend to a heel, adjust it again, as if showing off shoes was simply just a pastime, that things really didn't matter, looking at the window whilst walking, would best we walk tentatively in shoes.
Okay, well, thank you for the SoundCloud, Titus. Yeah, I thought this was a great response to I'm guessing prompt one. And I loved how he uses the concept of vogue to illustrate the passage of time. Yeah, prompt one. And its ephemeral nature, all embodied in that mysterious archetypal she. Great poem. And Pam, what'd you think?
Yeah, I've actually done this form before, the reverse ethery, and I like that he did this form in a description of a woman, because it does have a very hourglass type look to it. It also always impresses me when somebody can get a point across, of a main point across, like the description of this woman and, you know, how she feels about herself. You know, she feels, you know, confident and flirtatious. And he gets this across while staying within the syllable count of each line. I really like the alliteration in fittingly flirtatious. And then it says, she'll pass, turn, smile to look at herself, tend to a heel, adjust again, as if showing off shoes. And I think this doesn't just apply to women and shoes, though it's, you know, a good example. But oftentimes when we feel like we have something that we can show off with pride, we'll do those little movements to make sure that it gets drawn attention to. So just a wonderful creative write, an excellent SoundCloud, and very well done.
Great comment, Sam. And Laurent, your thoughts?
Yeah, I'll reference that stanza as well, as if showing off shoes was simply just a pastime. Now it ends, would best we walk tentatively in shoes. Now, I got to say, I don't know where you got the information on the prompts, but the poem in front of me was written 9 years ago, and then it was entered into a contest or into another radio show. So if there was a prompt to go with this exercise in form, I missed it, assuming there wasn't, though, because it is 9 years. He described that wonderful pastime we all indulge in, viewing ourselves as of its might, you know, in a new jacket or in a pair of shoes. And, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's a store window or mirror. Sometimes we like what we see. Other times, maybe not so much, but care is required. It's the feet that wear the shoes and go a-wandering.
Excellent comment. Yeah, and I guess what happened was when Titus saw the prompt, he had a poem from 9 years ago, and he put it into the group, the group's board, or the show's board. So I figured we're probably talking about prompt one as the match, because it was really talking about, you know, life and what happens between the space of birth and death. So, but anyway, that was my read on it. I could be off. And with that, Pam, whenever you're ready.
All right. Up next, we have Holiday Dinner by Mahershala Ali, 1848. And Richard, would you give that a read for us, please?
Sure. Okay, so this is Mahershala Ali, 1848, Holiday Dinner. My cousin is a poet of long lines and flowy adjectives. Her verse is free. Her verse is a reflection back to she. It cannot be constrained by rules of rhyme. I go to hear her read, chapbook in hand, on folding chairs, with tea and Oreos, and I confess I do not understand. Most times, the content of her folios. Tonight, however, every difference in our lived lives, our love, and how we think, swirls swiftly into insignificance as we wash dishes at the kitchen sink. In sink and full, I wash my cousin dries amidst the chatter of our family. End poem. Okay, Laurent, if we can start with you.
Well, it was part of the poem towards the end that you just read, amidst the chatter of our families. It talks about washing dishes at the kitchen sink with someone who is a poet of long lines, whose attitudes in life, her verse, is somebody who cannot be constrained by rules or rhymes. And he confesses, I do not understand most times the content of her folios. Now, hang on, I'm sorry. You know, at certain levels, common bonds of family and friendship are much more important than any esoteric appreciations of skill and art. Dishwashing is such a bond. However fleeting, I thought it was a fine work.
Great comment. And Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, it is definitely great at work. I like how she writes it in almost like a flow of consciousness. I like that, you know, as Lauren brought up the beginning, my cousin is a poet of long lines, flowy adjectives, her verse is free. You know, like she describes her cousin's poetry, and I like how not only like the shortness and the choice of simple wording in her poetry shows that she writes different than her cousin. And then I appreciate that this shows how poets come in different styles. You know, I like the, you know, I must confess I don't always understand, you know, what she says in the middle of her poem. But the meat of this poem, the heart of this poem, the most important part is the idea of being there with her cousin, working side by side, washing dishes, you know, expressing, you know, as we wash dishes, as the kitchen sink and full, I wash my cousin dries amidst the chatter of our families. And what that says to me is it doesn't matter if we all have our different poetry styles. It doesn't matter if we don't always understand each other's thoughts. But, you know, we can find those different ways to be connected and to express a caring and an understanding for one another. But I felt this poem had a lot of heart to it and was very well done.
Great comment, Pam. Yeah, you know, it's funny because I first read this kind of on the nose, that it was really about art and society, specifically the family, the interplay between them, and the thread of how love pervades them both. And interestingly, I'm now kind of thinking it could be like a metaphor, you know, that gosh, I'm going to lose it, but it's been a long day, but I'll get it. that the two styles of poetry and the two cousins are actually kind of like the two hands that are required in order for any kind of creativity to occur or any type of strong offering of creativity, or the strongest offerings of creativity are often require more than one hand. And the idea is best to give while your hand is still warm. This idea that collaboration between different personalities, different styles, one very erudite, one more down to earth and simple, is required to make something beautiful in the art world as well as in family. So anyway, I could be totally off when you get into metaphors, but I kind of did think of it the second time around. So with that, let's move on to our next one.
All right. And up next we have, let's see here, Coup d'Etat by Eric Svensson, and we have a SoundCloud for that, Richard.
Yep, coming up.
Coup d'Etat. We're made of stardust, hun, says who? Crinkle of chipmunk nose, eyes periscope. A new survey of 150,000 stars says so. We in our galaxy have about 90% of the same kind of atoms. Research found the elements of life appear to be more prevalent toward our galaxy's center. Did you put the garbage out, love? Hun, isn't it great to know we're made out of stardust? Chipmunk scowls. All those zillions of stars died so we could be born. Love, the garbage collectors will be here any minute now. Methuselah's sigh escapes pursed lips. CHNOPS star man stands up. Conglomerate of carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, and sulfur whistles. David Bowie's star man. Behind him, a supernova smile radiates event horizon. Her voice celebrates the CHNOPS star man. Oh, baby, how your cute butt makes them blue jeans talk. Pillow talk much later revolves around spectroscopy. Say what, hun? Spectroscopy is a method astronomers use to evaluate each element's abundance. Each element emits distinct wavelengths of light from within a star. The depth of the dark and bright patches in each star's light spectrum is measured to determine what it is made of. Chirpy chipmunk retort has him swooning. Kind of what your tongue likes doing, hun. Coup d'etat, end poem.
Great poem. Thanks so much for the SoundCloud there, Eric. And I love the humorous dialogue between hun and love, their interplay between sacred musings regarding astronomy and the ordinary garbage that needs to be taken out. Fun and funny, and quite appropriate for an evening of solar rock. Okay, and Pam, your thoughts?
I enjoyed this. This made me smile. You know, I like I said, I haven't read Philip Roth, so I do admit to doing some cram reading about on his biography just before the show, just so I'd have a little bit to know. And I did read that he used a lot of like humor, like in his writes, to address thoughts. And I think Eric did that. I mean, what is more simple? What, I mean, honest to goodness, the idea of chipmunks having a philosophical discussion is just absolutely a smile-inducing idea that just grabs your attention. And what I like about this is he looks at the idea of the life and death, the constant changing of the universe itself. And for him to do it in such a way as this chipmunk conversation, it's creative, it's fun. I like how he brings us into the pillow talk. It makes me think of how oftentimes when you're really interested in something and other people aren't as interested and you start to see in their face and it's like, but you just can't stop. I mean, like, you know, I don't know about you, but sometimes I get around friends and family that don't like poetry as much as I like poetry, and I realize I have to switch gears because I've been talking too long. But yeah, fun and creative, and takes a really great look at the whole thought of the creation of the, each individual little star. So very well done.
Great comment, Pam. And Laron, your thoughts?
Sure. Pam, I really do think that the Chirpy Chipmunk is an endearment for his wife. But be that as it may, there are two parts. Each element emits distinct wavelengths of light from within a star, the depth of the dark and bright patches. Each star's light spectrum is measured to determine what it was made. Fine. There's a solid dollop of science there. And then he uses really a very sophisticated, creative, humorous story in order to make a strong point here about anything that he's interested in. She's interested in more mundane matters, more real-life concerns. You know, I don't care what I'm made of. I don't care about the stars and you know, that they give birth to us, et cetera, et cetera. It's just an amusing look at where people's minds are. And then her retort has him swooning, kind of what your tongue likes doing on coup d'etat. I mean, I had a good guffaw, because basically he's giving us lingual spectroscopy, which is just wonderful. You know, he blended the science of love with the cosmic proportions of the universe.
Great comment. Okay, and with that, let's turn for our next one.
All right, let's see here. Okay. Here we go. All right. Up next we have Mortality and Its Play by Uma71. And Lauren, would you give that a read for us, please?
Sure enough. Things fall, slip from fingers. Somehow, the glass bowl manages to be held as spoonfuls tremble on lips, crossing path with air's inlet. Emotions of dread stirred, spilling disgust, one that you avoided when leakages from sphincters resigned their secrets. And you had faith all along in your mind's total control over automatic centers, its supremacy fizzling, not remembering what you ate for supper. Lucky those who manage a power play, walking, talking, feeding, delivering, a mind-body balance, managing mechanics, therapeutics, and logistics of living long. You still want to hit a century, calling in cellular soldiers for an all-out effort to stop this massacre on streets of day-to-day survival. Each cell, a single standalone, ill-equipped warrior against the assault of death. when you sleep troubled in the arms of senescence. Like every man, you still want to hang on to this thread of breath. End poem.
Great read, Laurent. Yeah, boy, what a powerful poem. He still wants to hit a century, calling in cellular soldiers for an all-out effort to stop this massacre of the streets and day-to-day survival. So painful. Oof. Just on a visceral level. But amazing work on the paradox of reverence for life and the massacre of old age. I was very impressed by where she took this prompt. The prompt is, old age isn't a battle. Old age is a massacre. And, you know, Uma 71, most of her work is just very spiritual and you know, very etheric and inspirational. But she took this prompt and really cuts it right to the bone of what the human experience is, that life force meeting tragedy of old age. And just very skillful, almost painful read, very well done. And Pam, what'd you think?
Oh, I have to agree with you. Oh, my goodness. You know, the fact that she uses such powerful and visceral imagery, spilling disgust, one that you avoided when its leakages from sphincters resigned their secrets. You know, the idea that not only are you losing, as you age, you might be losing control of your mind, but losing control of your body. I think for me personally, that's one of my biggest fears is, well, I've always had that thing about always having to feel like I'm in control. And I think, you know, that as the body ages, as the mind ages, and I've worked at a nursing home, and you see when people get to that point where their body doesn't work, their mind doesn't work, there's just a shell of themselves. And so she captures that in those lines that I just mentioned. And she also captures how we just have this urge, this natural urge to keep fighting death. Each cell, a single standalone, ill-equipped warrior against the assault of death. It's as if your whole body is going to a battle that it knows it's going to lose, but it goes there anyways. Wow, emotive and powerful and just absolutely very well done.
Great insights, Pam. And Laurent, your thoughts?
You two young whippersnappers sitting there talking that age. Now, you guys are both old enough to begin to feel the aging process because, you know, every year things change. But I promise you, all the rumors are true. When you get another 2-3 decades on you, this poem will make a lot more. I mean, you understand it intellectually, but it's not until you get to a certain age that you begin to feel it emotionally, at any rate. And you had faith all along in your body, in your mind's total control over automatic centers, its supremacy fizzling, not remembering what you ate for supper. This is very sharp writing. Aging, it is a slow-motion massacre, and we watch in horror each new dawn, and there is no defense, even with her cellular soldiers. I enjoyed this a great deal.
Great comment, yeah. Okay, Pam, where do we go?
All right, and let's see here. Up next, we have... All right. Free Falling by T. Michelle. And I'll go ahead and give this a read. And it goes like this. We were the earth held up by the sun and her cluster of a gazillion rose mallow, or so we thought. Love is a vineyard with wet seeds and baby twigs to be fermented with oaths from the lips of a caregiver. I suppose it was a fermenting of our heartstrings when the crystalline sky toasted the clouds and we had our way with the arc of the moon. It was chaos and it was perfection. It was the stars swirling like fireflies on gold grass. I was raptured by the fire water scotch pet pearls dangling in the olive lee and your wings gliding through Barja scented breeze across Oriental mead until we discovered gravity, a form we'd never been, after effects of reality, slopping down the tongue to the swollen navel, half warm as it loses the sweetness of candy tufts and vespertine lilies. Quaffing up our warranty, we made it so we're plowed by the littlest tempest at the behest of fatigue, a lesion that sauna springs couldn't dare to cure. Love was a vine with sun-dried seeds and fragile twigs we sowed in dark cavern and fermented with maggots in the palms of violence. We've rejected yet another milestone and home.
Wow, great job there, Pam. What a right. So this was prompt 4, the only obsession everyone wants, love. People think that falling in love, they make themselves whole. The platonic union of souls, I think otherwise. I think you're whole before you begin, and love fractures you. You're whole, and then you're cracked open. And boy, skillfully outlined the life cycle of love, from wet seeds all the way to maggots and the palms of violence. And yet I read a resilience and perhaps a compulsion to persist in love and loving in the final stanza. We've reached yet another milestone. The imagery, metaphors are breathtakingly good. This is truly a work of word art. You know, we're so fortunate. We have some amazing poets that drop by every 2 weeks and give us just amazing work. And this is another example. Wonderful. And Laurent, your thoughts.
Certainly, without any exaggeration, a poem like this is good enough to be published, as are many, I hasten to ask. But this is genuinely, genuinely good. You might call it abstract, but it's not. It's metaphorically complex. But to move from the metaphor of a vineyard as love, fermenting of the heartstrings when he was raptured by her initially, and then they discovered gravity, kind of brought everything down to earth. The swollen navel, half warm, because it's lost the sweetness of candy tufts and vespertine lilies, and then the dissolution of the relationship, coughing up our warranty. We made it so we're plowed by the littlest tempest at the behest of fatigue. No real way to cure it. And back to the vineyard again. Love as a vine with sun-dried seeds and fragile twigs. The reference to the maggots is pretty intense. We've reached yet another milestone. Yeah, a milestone in love. This is damn good.
Amen. Absolutely. And Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah. I like how Laurence, first of all, that you used the word genuine to describe this poem. And I think that was a spot on choice for this. I love how this is so heartfelt. And it's about that sudden grasp on reality. You know, the way that, first of all, the way love makes us feel. to a point where, you know, the cloud is toast, or the sky is toasting the clouds, and, you know, we're having our way with the arc of the moon. It's just beautiful imagery to describe how you just feel like on cloud nine. And I really like also coughing up our warranty. We made it so we're plowed by Lilith's tempest and behest of fatigue. Elysian, the sauna springs couldn't dare to cure. Amazing imagery and metaphors. A great look at how love can change so quickly from that, you know, that everything's beautiful to everything's ugly, and that walking away, that kind of loss of connection and of self. So beautifully written and very well done.
Absolutely. And with that, we are ready for our next one.
All right. Well, up next, I have your poem, Richard. So whenever you're ready, give it a read.
Okay. So let's see. Where am I here? Okay. Hold on one sec. My cat distracted me at that crucial moment, but I'm back. Okay, here we go. So this one is inspired by the Roth quote, "You be greater than your feelings. I don't demand this of you. Life does. Otherwise, you'll be washed away by feelings. You'll be washed out to sea and never seen again." So the poem is called "Beyond Mere Feelings." White-hot anger vomits forth like lava. Now cool blue serenity soothes weeping wounds, while grieving black death shrouds engulf all round. Rabbit runs through fear-stained green meadows, and still our earth spins round and round. Each imperceptible beat twists us to another angle of life's color-coded feeling wheel. Yes, beyond each smile, tear, howl, scream, and shudder, I rise. My mind dances in elliptical waves of this transcendent, God-headed spine of truth. End poem.
Wonderful read and write there, Richard. And Lawrence, let's start with your thoughts about this poem.
Absolutely. One question, Richard. Is the feelings wheel real? Or is that a creation of yours?
So, this is real. Actually, therapists use it when a lot of people are dissociated from their feelings. Then
right.
they pull out the wheel and say, "Where are you?"
It's almost like the Lucier color test, but a little more specific.
Yeah. Yeah.
At any rate, you set the stage, and then you deliver the must do. Yet beyond each smile, tear, howl, scream, and shudder, I rise. My mind dances in elliptical waves of this transcendent, God-headed spine of truth. First of all, I like the fact you wrote a brevity because you don't normally, and you accomplish so much within it. The implication to me was if you control your feelings, you control the world, so to speak. It is a spine of truth. I thought it was a lovely poem.
Thanks so much.
Great comment there, Lawrence. And yeah, it's really cool to see that feelings wheel there. And I wondered the same thing too, Lawrence. I like this brevity very much. I really like how you bring us into the turmoil of emotions in that first stanza. And then the reminder that, you know, emotions aren't always the truth. It's not that they're not valid. I mean, you always, in any given moment that you feel something, it's valid to feel angry, even if people, other people don't feel angry about it. It's valid to feel fear. I like that you brought in the imagery of the rabbit runs. While grieving, black dust shrouds engulf all around rabbit run. That makes me think of the book and the cartoon movie Watership Down. But and then to me, the whole poem is important, but it's that second stanza, that last stanza, that really reminds us that we have to have something to focus on, whether it's something within ourselves or something outside of ourselves, something that reminds us that while emotions are valid, and they're not always the truth, that sometimes they can lead us to a point of confusion. And as you mentioned, you have that. You have that something that amidst the emotions, the howls, the screams, and the shudders, there's a spine of truth to focus on. And so just a beautiful and thought-provoking write, and very well done.
Thanks so much, Pam. Yeah, you know, the interesting thing was that I looked at the feelings wheel, and I never realized this before, but at the very center is that black dot, and that made me think, oh, this is the spine of truth, that, you know, it's you're feeling your feelings, and you're allowing yourself to go anywhere on that wheel, and yet you're always remembering that you're more than your feelings, that you are that spine of truth in the center, that can experience them, but that's not, as Roth accurately says, is not washed out to sea by them. So that's what inspired me.
Very cool.
And with that, we're ready for our next one.
All right. Well, Lawrence, you are up next. Are you on mute, Lawrence?
Yeah, I was trying to pick up the link. I got it.
Oh, okay.
All right, I wrote to the props, there's no remaking reality. Just take it as it comes. And he had learned the worst lesson that life can teach. It makes no sense. And this reflects those attitudes. Scenes from a silent movie, A Fine Madness. Omni initium difficile est. Life is a sovereign bitch who will slap you with an open hand, rarely the iron fist. Reality takes care of itself, even when it babbles in truncated grunts that hold no meaning or sense. It mates me with demons inculcating schizophrenia. Run, run, they're coming. Scenes from a silent movie. Feature-length extravaganza accompanies war news of the day. Loud shouting in the theater. Screen goes dark. Ushers man the Clyde lights. Kong bursts through the silver screen. A blonde woman faints, waiting to be carried away. She prefers the monkey of her dreams. Instead of you, of me. Large gorillas of moxie always win. Today's reality lists to port, swinging at anchor in wild sides. Never enough lifeboats to save everyone. In an alphabet of despair, trains run past shanty towns. Nightly, owls bristle at the Doppler shift. Always rising, always falling. A horn to bring down Jericho's walls, sending multitudes into a fine madness. Stand firm against the teeth of the gale. Make no attempt to divert its fury. Let it take you like a balloon, skywards. Ride the white crests. There is no remaking of the wave that tumbles you under. Bend to its will and survive, intact. Open reality's ample legs wide. Take the plunge into life and impregnate the bitch. Deeds, not words, to make any sense of it at all. End poem.
Wow. great read, Laurence, and great poem. Let's get Pam's thoughts first. Go ahead, Pam.
Wow, this is just, I really like this. This is right away from the beginning, life is a sovereign bitch who will slap you with an open hand, rarely the iron fist. And that is so true. Oftentimes, you know, it isn't that iron fist that comes down. It's that slap. I like how you bring us into Kong bursts through the silver screen. A blonde woman faints, waiting to be carried away. She prefers the monkey of her dreams instead of you and me. Large gorillas with moxie always win. And from there, there's this kind of feeling of, you know, you have to live life to the fullest. You have to get out there and have moxie. Strong imagery and metaphors all the way through. In an alphabet of despair, trains run past shanty towns, nightly owls bristle as Doppler's shift, always rising, always falling, a horn to bring down Jericho's walls, sending multitudes into a fine madness. You know, I just thought that was a really powerful metaphor for, you know, kind of like it made me feel like the idea of the story of the boy who cries wolf. Yeah, and strong ending, open realities, ample legs, why take a plunge into life and impregnate the bitch, deeds, not words, to make any sense of it all. You know, you're not going to make sense of life by sitting in your armchair and being an armchair philosopher. Making sense out of life means moving forward and living it, like actually living it, not just in your mind. And so wonderful, right, and very well done, Laurent.
Thank you.
Great insights, Pam. Yeah, Laurent, it's just like watching someone who's been playing baseball for 20 years. They know their craft. They know where every batter is, and they know exactly where they want to place that pitch. They're right at their prime. It's like that Nolan Ryan moment, you know, and that's what you bring us here. Kaleidoscopic search for meaning invokes not only King Kong and Fay Wray, but also the logistical flaws of the Titanic, suggesting that reality lists support, and yet your final invocation affirms the worth of our journey. Open realities, legs wide, take the plunge into life and impregnate it to make sense at all. I have to say, you gave voice to my feelings on the topic being life, quite well. And just an inspirational piece, my friend. Great.
High praise. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, let's move on to our next one, Pam.
All right. Up next, we have What About Me by Neutron Bomb. And it goes like this. Rosy warm hands give with formidable ease. Splitting orange pyramid, sunny boy, icy poles between siblings. Before the weight of winter's cold stole blood from their fingertips. And the individual's needs took pride of place over the collective needs of the hive. A radiant smile, a press on the arm, a button or locket of hair, doted on with admiration. And innocence bled down a sinkhole. Save, spend, donate. I had the latter two down pat. It was a spendthrift whirlwind that saw money disappear down a sieve. My cool hands oppressed by winter's frost gave until frostbite set in. Time to save for a rainy day. Make hay while the sun shines. End poem.
Great read, Pam. And that was prompt 8. It's best to give while your hand is still warm. And wow, just, you know, my co-host really without the stops here. My cool hands, oppressed by winter's frost, gave until frostbite set in. Time to save for a rainy day. Make hay while the sun shines. As with virtually everything in life, balance is the key. Even the kind act of giving can lead to frostbite and run counter to Roth's admonition to give while your hand is still warm. I thought it was brilliant metaphors, a brilliant philosophical take on the prompt. Very well done. And Laurent, your thoughts?
Yeah, I thought her use of a metaphor as age for the way hands feel. You know, when you're young, those hands are nice and warm, and it's easy to do anything, really, including giving, participating, supporting, all the things we do in the family unit or at work, et cetera. But when you get older, year after year, the cold of the autumn finds a way into your hands, which do begin to ache, and you become very, very sensitive. And it's that metaphor for aging. It's very, very difficult after a while just to take care of yourself, let alone have to participate and take care of others. So at that point, as she says, save, spend, donate. I have the latter two down pat. The spendthrift whirlwind that saw money disappear down a sieve. You know, it was time now, because frostbite had stayed in that cold, to save for a rainy day. You know, she's now finally doing something for herself. And you have to. Great piece.
Absolutely. Great comment. And Pam, as Rita, I'll give you final words.
Well, first of all, I have to say I'm very amused because it just so happened today, her end line, I was discussing with my roommate winter weather and especially, like, you know, well, Wisconsin weather, and how up and down it can be during springtime. And he actually said the exact phrase, make hay while the sun shines. So I thought, how just ironic and funny that it is that I see that phrase, or hear that phrase, and then see it in Neutron's poem. I like how she brings up the idea of the individual struggle and how, you know, that separation between, you know, siblings, between friends, and then talks about she save, spend, donate. I had the latter two down pat. And that is so true for many of us. So many of us, we don't put away for that rainy day. We're good at the spending. We're even good at the donating, giving. But we don't necessarily, like, have it to where we know we'll have the hay to put together on that sunny day. I really like the imagery in this throughout. Thought it was just absolutely stunning and very well done.
Great comment. Okay, and with that, we're ready for our next one.
All right. Let me see here. Here we go. Seven, the next one. And up next, we have Hate and Love by Weaver of Dreams. And we have a SoundCloud for that one.
Okay.
I see you walking through the park every day, serene, untouched, while my brain seethes with thoughts of revenge, retribution, tendrils of rotting hatred rise and broil, leaving me weak. Anger this intense wreaks havoc on the body, fractures the mind. At night I plot and plan how to get close to you and what I'd do. Could I end you? Swat you like a fly, crush you like a cockroach. Or would a silent poison-tipped dart from a blowpipe be the answer? The thought that my hatred of you hurts me while you are immune slices one more layer of skin from my twisted, knotted, tortured body. This has to end. One of us must die. I can't live like this another second. You may have moved on, but you've not moved away. I have to see you both hand in hand all hugs and laughter, smiles and kisses. Tonight, I'll do it tonight. Wait, who's this? Oh, the new French teacher. Enchanted, Mr. Truchet. You would like me to show you around the town? Perhaps at dinner? Tonight? Why not? I have no one, I mean, nothing to do tonight. I'm all yours.
Wow, what a sound class. And I have to say, this was a visceral pain of hatred, masterfully exposed with the thought that my hatred of you hurts me while you are immune, slices one more layer of skin from my twisted, knotted, tortured body. And I love that arc with Mr. Truchet, and how we wonder if our heroine is setting herself up for yet another downward spiral in the future. I thought this was great psychological storytelling, right out of like Alfred Hitchcock type stuff. And Laurent, what'd you think?
Well, it's funny how people interpret poetry differently. I've got kind of a different take on this piece.
Cool.
I think it really is almost farcical, funny, because the hyperbole and the different little plots that she's concocting in her mind, and the tone and the words she used, could I end you, swat you like a fly, crunch you like a cockroach. Or would a silent poison tip dart from a blowpipe be the answer? That's not hatred. That's almost mock hatred, the way she writes it. It doesn't sound serious to me. I mean, it does in places, yes. But all the way through, and it follows the inevitability of many a fine comic routine when she says, you may have moved on, but you've not moved away. I have to see you both hand in hand, all hugs and laughter, smiles and kisses. Tonight, I'll do tonight. Wait, who's this? Oh, the new French teacher. Doesn't miss a beat. No pause, no nothing. The tone lightens right up. She's enchanted. She's forgotten the hatred. It's gone. Not even the thought of it anymore. Right now, I'm all yours. The move from the hatred to the interest is too fast, in my mind, to be anything but very subtle humor.
I like it. I like that interpretation. Very cool. And Pam, what do you think?
Yeah, I thought this was really cool. I like, a great observation there, Lauren. I really love the creativity that she puts in this and the idea of, you know, maybe it is supposed to be real anger, maybe it isn't, but the fact that she puts in here that the character has got this little list of what could they possibly do, and even goes as far as, or would a silent poison tip dart from a blowpipe be the answer? You know, I thought that was just creative and, you know, kind of a dark, twisted humor.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, nobody says tendrils of rotting hatred writhe and boil. Nobody says that, right? Sorry.
Absolutely. Yeah, I have to agree. See you both hand in hand, all hugs and laughter, smiles and kisses. Tonight, I'll do it tonight. Wait, who's this? Oh, the new French teacher. How easily the mind of this character is distracted. It's kind of like that idea of how fickle love can be, how easily distracted the mind and the libido can be. So just an absolutely intriguing and fun write and very well done.
Great comment. Okay, and with that, let's move on to our next one.
Ah, right. Now the question is, did I grab the next one? Yes, I did. Okay. Sometimes I can't tell if I'm a step ahead or a step behind. But up next...
I know, it goes fast when there's just three of us.
Right? Up next, we have Painful Things in Life by Martha Gettle, and there's a SoundCloud for that.
Yep, got it.
The Painful Things in Life by Martha Gettle. The painful things in life can cut just like a knife. The blade can cut so deep that you can't even weep. Then it's time to stand tall for you to rise up above it all. Set your mind on being strong and find the strength to go on. For you have got to live your life with all its pleasures and its strife. Set your heart toward tomorrow. Turn your back on yesterday's sorrow. Life is all contained in how you face it. The past is done, you can't erase it. And life goes on no matter how we fight, whether for the wrong or for the right. For now you have got to live your life with all its pleasures and its strife. Set your heart toward tomorrow. Turn your back on yesterday's sorrow. Life is just a journey, you see. Hiding good and bad there for you and me. And peace and hope for your mind is the best that we can hope to find.
Thank you for the song, Martha. Okay. Pam, let's start with you. What do you think?
Well, as always, I appreciate the SoundCloud that Martha and anybody who makes SoundClouds does. I like how this is a song filled with hope and the idea that you don't spend your time looking back, that you move forward in life. You have this hope, this faith that there's going to be a brighter tomorrow. I really like that chorus, for you have got to live your life with all its pleasures and its strife. And I like that she doesn't deny that there's strife. You know, there is hardships in life, but, you know, set your heart toward tomorrow, turn back on yesterday's sorrow. Move forward, enjoy the journey. I thought this was very well done.
Absolutely. Great, great comment. And you hit the same stanza, the chorus that I highlighted in my comments. It just struck me. You've got to live your life with its pleasure and its strife. Set your heart on tomorrow. Turn your back on yesterday's sorrow. Which, you know, first of all, easier said than done in the moment when we're getting triggered by the emotions. But nevertheless, that's definitely the aspiration for me. I thought it was another inspirational, life-affirming song straight from the heart. That's where she shoots from. And no one does these quite like her. They are always amazing additions to the show. They bring music, that a cappella voice. It's always a real great ad, and this one was no exception. And Laurent, your thoughts?
Yeah, each stanza could really stand alone, except maybe for the first, because each one is a positive affirmation of how you conduct yourself, what you must do, and how life treats you. I was taken by the life is all contained in how you face it. Past is done, you can't erase it. And life goes on no matter how we fight, whether for the wrong or for the right. And then that is basically echoed somewhat throughout the entire poem. So I thought that she handled the prompt very well.
Absolutely. Great comment. Okay, and Pam, I see we've got our next one up. And who would you like
Ode to the Cockles by If You're Abs. And Richard, would you give that a read for us, please?
Absolutely. Okay, so this one is If You're Abs, and it's called Ode to the Cockroach. It goes like this. Cockroach, bloody cockroach, you're like a Cowboys fan coming out of 4 a.m. woodwork, antenna up like a twittering periscope. On das Boot. We're the color of your armor on the hair of a fair Fraulein maiden and the creamy blood careening from my fist bottled as perfumed lotion. A world of darkness might turn into flowery poetry spread to like-minded impresario beetles. But now you run from my fists as I pound hot pads and silverware and spoons, fly an acrobatic somersault flip, vanish to a toilet bowl world of chemicals called vanish, only to reemerge when Troy Boy calls you super. End of poem. Oh, yeah, that one got me laughing both times when I read it. Okay, Laurent, Buffalo Bill's up there, right? You get the first word.
All right. I did not answer this particular poem, but Archie did, and he wrote, "Read your poem with misgivings. The Cowboys be damned. Our antennae serve one purpose, vibration and food location. Troy has nothing on us. Infiltration began long ago. Yes, Das Boot is a favorite. Pressure in the extreme, out of sight. Our common fate and skill set, torpedoes away."
Great comment. And
you got to think about
Archie,
it a little bit,
right?
That's right.
Okay, and okay. So I am going to pause here, just because I know that you're in Bill's country, right up there, Laurent?
Yes, we are.
Okay,
life is
so.
Yeah, go ahead.
And Cowboys, it's not like the Eagles. I know. So Steve is, you know, there's this Eagles-Cowboys rivalry, but certainly there's no love lost between the Bills and the Cowboys. I mean, you know, it's not like, it's not like they haven't had their run-ins, especially if you're old enough like we are, you know,
the 70s
were Bills were, yep.
Yeah. The Buffalo Bills will always be wide right. You know, the field goal that went wide right, they didn't get the Super Bowl.
Oh, yeah, right.
That's unfortunately in my head. I'm pretty consistent about that.
Yeah, right. Okay, so on to Pam. What'd you think?
Oh, I really like this. I like that, you know, it touches on two realities for many people's lives, the competitiveness of you know, whose team is against whose team, but also how, you know, things can just take over. You know, cockroaches are a good example, and yuck. I mean, they get in your walls and they infest, and, you know, any type of insect pest. And there are many people out there who very much are like insect pests. Do you know that aphids, from the time they reach old enough to be breeders, which is within the first week or so of life, give birth every day until they die? Every freaking day. And sometimes it feels like there's those type of people out there that they're just, I don't know. I mean, they're like aphids. They're like the human equivalent of aphids. And they're, you know, but I'm sorry, I'm probably sounding a little mean, but I like the humor in this. I like that he chose to reference the movie Das Boot and the idea of that Nazi-like mindset. I also, now, as someone who actually lived in Austin, Texas for a while and lives up here in Wisconsin, I can tell you that both Cowboy fans and Packer fans are very crazy at times and very loyal. Though I highly favor the loyalty of a Packer fan over that of a Cowboy fan, but that's just my personal opinion. You know, I thought this was creative and fun and just an excellent write all the way through.
Absolutely. Great comment. Yeah. Boy, this one really, it does. It's a great poem. It can be read on multiple levels. You can take it at face value and go into the whole diatribe about the cowboys. You can look at the cockroach and how people can be cockroaches. So it's got it all. But I'm going to go with my original comment. The Cowboys, America's team, the team we love to hate, kind of like the team that I actually love, which is in baseball, the New York Yankees, another team that people love to hate. Das Boot, I thought it was especially funny as I started suddenly thinking about German U-boats sinking merchant vessels in the North Atlantic during World War II, and I was off in that tangent. But no, it's the boot to kill the cowboy cockroaches. And I was back on track, ready for Aikman's super commentating on ESPN, jet fuel remarks or not. I thought there was a great barrage of inside jokes, and yet I loved how this poem works, even if you don't know anything about NFL football, which is truly the mark of good poetry, is that it works on multiple levels, and he does it in a very, very funny way,
hey, Richard,
which he's really good at. Yeah.
Name me two things that are basically invisible, but everybody knows they're there. Submarines and cockroaches.
Okay. Right.
Absolutely.
Very good, Pat. Absolutely. Yeah, I didn't even catch that until you pointed it out. Great job there. Okay, and with that, let's move on to our next one, Pam.
All right, up next we have Like the Zebra by Sidney Pierce. And Lawrence, will you give that a read for us, please?
Yes, ma'am. Polka dots and thick wavy stripes are popular accessories among some animals. Take the zebra with its clashing white on black. Or is it black on white? It is the most noticeable of prey, and yet it wears this title proudly, as if challenging big cats to even dream of a massacre. Man wears his polka dot dye in the same, but prey is matched by the greatest predator called life. Life sinks its imaginary teeth deep in the bloated, thin skin and rips free the muscles of stability with no sense of execution, only causing pain for enjoyment. Life wears a red dress and dances so delicately through the valleys between fingers, barely out of reach. And like the zebra, you will perish just for the fun of it all. End poem.
Great reading, Yeah, I thought this was a well-crafted metaphor. Really excellent riffing off of the prompt. It's a great job there. And, Pam, what'd you think?
I really like this one, when, especially as the metaphor of idea of us looking, being like those zebras that look for death. You know, the irony being that actually their stripes do work as a form of camouflage, especially when they walk in groups. You know, so to me there's almost that idea of, you know, stepping outside of the safety zone. Yeah, you've proven yourself an individual, but have you put yourself in the line of fire, the line of danger? You know, and I really like this all the way through, but what stands out for me is life wears a red dress. And I thought that was particularly powerful because the red dress being a symbol of heart disease. So I thought, well, that was a perfect choice in the idea of, because it is, physical death comes when the heart stops and the brain stops. And so if life always wears that red dress, then life is, you know, always looking to perish, for to death. And so just an intriguing rite all the way through and very well done.
Absolutely. Great comment. And Laurent, your song.
Yeah, we are what we are, you know. But a good costume can help matters. Life will triumph in the end. But a few battles can be won, even in a losing cause. In the meantime, we dance, tie and all. Excellent, right? Metaphorically, very satisfying.
Absolutely, yeah, it's a really good metaphor. Okay, and with that, we are ready for our next one.
All right, let's see here. Here we go. All right. And up next, we have Raw's Complaint by Anton Ansford 37, and it goes like this. Unlike being a brain surgeon or a London taxi driver, there is set curriculum for being a writer. The boundary is incredibly vague that sets apart Wordsworth from McGungle. We float along on our sea of quiddity, grasping at straws to make our art, but like small weirdness, such as Redmond O'Hanlon's Fetish Room or Chatwin's Forcing the Makers to Remake Moleskine. We probe our friends and rivals to find out if they have escaped the maze or if our personal minotaur has crept behind us and wound the thread back to the beginning, leaving us stranded in our madness. End poem.
Nicely read, Pam. Not an easy poem to read either. And I love this. You know, so first of all, the nod to Portnoy's Complaint. And I have to say that, you know, Roth is just such a talented writer, and everything that he did so well. And I think probably The Human Stain is the standout where people look at it and say, oh my gosh, what an amazing piece of literature. But in terms of making you laugh and keeping you entertained while telling a great story, Portnoy's Complaint is still one of the funniest books I think I've ever read. And it's, you know, it's old, and it was stands the test of time. It's just so funny. And it was the funny part, and okay, this is the really funny part, is at the time it came out, it was like shocking
how dare this guy write about masturbation, you know? And, you know, nowadays it seems so tame compared to what's out there. But Hell, such a funny book. And so that, you know, I don't know. I kind of got caught up on that in and of itself, first of all. And then the complaint, right? The literary allusions that litter this complaint that is truly Locke-like in its self-deprecating humor and self-searching existential querying regarding writing and society as a whole. I just thought this was a great, great piece. Just really appropriate for a night of celebrating Philip Roth. And Laurent, what do you think?
Yeah, it's that madness is pervasive, isn't it? I like the examples that he gives of the Redmond O'Hanion's fetish room, or Chatwin's forcing the makers to remake Moleskine. And I'm assuming they're talking about a book cover, because I think Moleskine refers to the kind of leather on some of the books. And the reference to the maze of the Minotaur is oh so true. And I agree with everything that you said. Excellent piece.
Absolutely. Great comment. And Pam, what do you think?
All right, well, this, I really like Anton's style. There's kind of almost a flow. And I like how within his imagery he brings to us how writers are very self-aware but also very self-conscious of their flaws and oftentimes seeking approval to the point of driving themselves mad. So I just thought this was an excellent write and very well done.
Absolutely. Great comment. Okay. So with that, we're ready for our next one.
All right. Up next, we have, let's see here. Up next, we have Believing in Winter by Orange. And Orange, right? Yes. Lawrence, will you give that a read for us, please?
Yes, I will. Do I believe in winter? I just know it always comes. A few weeks ago, the blossoms were crumbling among snow, life and oblivion indistinguishable, and some took war for a lover. They thought her glorious, blood-stained rags of amaranthine velvet, black curls feathered on the wind of explosions. She would make them men. The universal song of dying, the squeaks and squeals, the gasps and groans, the rattles, the barely there misty whisper of a soul. And every second, at every corner, the withered daisy and the run-over pigeon, the earthworm naked to the sun. Just walking this morning, I must have stomped a thousand deaths. One day, pink bindweed will sprout from the impacts to strangle the surviving flocks. Creeping under cover of cracks to claim fences which only purpose is to keep bone-white rubble away from sight. End poem.
Wow, great read. And what a strong poem. Wow. And some took war for a lover. They thought her glorious, blood-stained rag of emerantine velvet, black curls feathered on the wind of explosion. She would make them men. A strong riffing off of the prompt. I like how she caught Roth's dark humor and took it into its logical, dark heart, finding there man's inhumanity driven by the fear of the other and lust
for the insanity of national and or racial pride, whose harvest is desolation. It's a wonderful addition to our evening celebrating Philip Roth. Great job. And Pam, your thoughts?
This is just strong imagery and metaphors all the way through. I like how it starts with the question, do I believe in winter? I just know it always comes. I like how it seems like, you know, winter being a metaphor for death. The thoughts are glorious blood-stained rags of amaranth and velvet, black curls feathered on the wind of explosions. She would make them men. I really like that personification. Well, it seems to me to be a personification almost of war. And then she brings us down to the imagery of the earthworm naked in the sun, you know, all the references to death that we see as children as we walk around and explore life and death and see, and the fascination with death, the fascination with the earthworm that wiggles itself out of the mud and is so alive and so happy and then lays in the sun and becomes that symbolism of death. You know, I just thought this was beautifully written and very well done.
Great comment, Pam. And Laurent, your thoughts?
Pam made a great comment. Can I steal it? No.
Sure, I'll put it up for sale.
You know, as a child, I stepped on a few earthworms myself. I bet all of us have. But there is one image that in my brain that I will always remember. And when I lived in New York City, well, we would walk everywhere as a child. At the time, I was probably 8 years old, just before we went back to France. And I looked down in the gutter of the street, and a pigeon had apparently been run over by a car. You know, it was probably pecking around under the car, then it moved. And the pigeon itself looked whole, except for the fact that its guts had just spewed out all over the place. And it was so shocking to me as a child to see the brutalness of the image. Ah, my God, I couldn't bear it. And I can't get rid of that particular memory to this day. And the evocation by the poet of the naked, the earthworms naked to the sun and the runover pigeon are very, very powerful to me. As is the stanza which talks about the universal song of dying, the squeaks and squeals, gasps and groans, the rattles, the barely there, misty whisper of a soul. What a great piece this is. I don't know if I'm missing any metaphors. If I am, it's going to be in that last stanza, which is a little tough for me to crack.
Great. Great comment, yeah. And I do want to just take a moment because prompt 13, I was very tempted to write to it because it's, first of all, it's from Portnoy's complaint, but second, it really is, you know, it's my ethnicity, so it's a great Jewish joke. It's a family joke that when I was a tiny child, I turned from the window out of which I was watching a snowstorm and hopefully asked, Mama, do you believe in winter? Because, you know, as kids, it's like you're inundated with, you know, oh, it's Christmas. Oh, we don't believe in Christmas. Oh, it's Easter. We don't believe in it. So it's, you know, granted, she didn't take it to that place. She took it to a really dark, desolate place and did so beautifully. But the joke is it's great. You know, it's just one of those things. It's, God damn it, do we get anything, you know? Do we get winter at least? I'm looking out at the snowstorm. Do we believe in it? And you know, just a great, great joke. Okay. With that, let's move on to our next one. Where are we going, Pam?
All right. Well, up next we have Apology by World in Colors, and it goes like this. I'm sorry. for all the time I spent lost in my own dreams. And, oh, I'm sorry. Jeez, let me start over again. I'm sorry for all the time I spent lost in my own storm and couldn't hold my own umbrella through the rain. For all the times I caused you pain when the scars in my heart were too much and I hurt both of us. I thought love was the solution. I used you as a crutch. I'm sorry. Though you're not innocent, I'm still guilty. I can't deny that sometimes all I wanted was for you to see right through me. I wonder if you know that I truly mean, or if you notice all the times I looked right through you and saw you get just as blue as I do, but hide it better than I do. I'm sorry for all that this apology is worth. I promise that I'll never again be the reason you hurt. End poem.
Great read, Pam. Yeah, I love this piece. I thought it was a strong, poetic apology, heartfelt and heartbreaking, highly identifiable throughout. I'm sorry for all the time I spent lost in my own storm and couldn't hold my own umbrella through the rain. What a great line. And Laurent, your thoughts?
Yeah, there's a little bit of a condemnation in the second major stanza. I wonder if you know what I truly mean, or if you notice all the times I look right through you. And so you get just as blue as I do, but hide it better than I do. Almost, you know, she says it would have been better if you had seen or been more honest. I'm wondering if perhaps that would have opened her up to be honest. And if they were blue, was it with each other or were there external circumstances? So, yeah, I see it as an apology, absolutely. And yet it's not a pure apology. It's almost a statement of facts from her perspective. Perhaps that's right. I'm not sure. It's late.
great comment, great insight. And Pam, I'll give you final word.
Yeah, I thought that was great insight, Lawrence. And I do feel like this is her point of view and her realization of what she did wrong in a friendship or a romantic relationship, but also, you know, hoping that other person sees what their part was. Like, it's that whole idea of it takes two to tango. I like that she put "I'm sorry" three times and as a break between stanzas. And it does seem like absolutely a genuine and heartfelt apology and a strong realization of how not only did you cheat, like, use somebody as a crutch, but also really wasn't even aware of their pain. But then again, maybe they weren't that aware of hers either. You know, it just seemed like a relationship of two blind and unaware people. So just really thought-provoking and emotive and very well done.
Great comment. Okay, as opposed to trying to rush through another poem, why don't you tell us what's coming up in a half an hour, Pam?
All right. Half an hour we have Into the Darkness, and the prompt was dark art, which basically I just went online and said, I like this picture, I like this picture, I like this picture. There's no specific artist, no specific theme. It's just dark art that Pam liked and put up in a contest. And, you know, poetry readers and commenters are always welcome.
Great. Sounds really cool. Okay. So I want to thank you, Laurent, for joining us. And special thanks to you, Pam, for jumping in and being our sub co-host. We are looking forward to Neutron's return in 2 weeks. And, of course, thanks to Fill My Eyes for all that she does in the background, making this show work. And final thanks to the poets that write the shows. Without you guys, there is no show. So, once again, very sincere thanks to everyone for this.
Oh, I know exactly what the next contest is going to be. We are going to be celebrating Cormac McCarthy.
Oh, great.
Nice. Great choice.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. It's a poet. It's a author that everyone knows, right? The Road and No Country for Old Men, all that stuff. So it'll be exciting. Okay, I think we're out. Thanks, everyone, for joining us.
Good night. Love
you
all.
Everyone.
Thank you. Love you, too.